chiseled teeth and muzzle dripping blood. There are night ghosts. Some people say that we can understand all things if we can know them. But there came a dark night in the fall when I thought that was wrong, and so did the dogs. We had been running all morning and were tired. Some of the dogs were young and could not sustain a long run, so we stopped in the middle of the afternoon when they seemed to want to rest. I made a fire, set up a gentle, peaceful camp, and went to sleep for 4 hours. It hadn't snowed yet, so we had been running with the three-wheel cart, which meant we had to run on logging roads and open areas. I had been hard-pressed to find new country to run in to keep the young dogs from becoming bored, and this logging trail was one that we had not run before. It had been rough going, with a lot of ruts and mud, and the cart was a mess, so that I spent some time fixing it after I awakened, carving off the dried mud. The end result was that we didn't get going again till close to 1 in the morning. This did not pose a problem, except that as soon as I hooked the dogs up and got them lined out, I was running an 8-dog team. My headlamp went out. I replaced the bulb and tried a new battery, but that didn't help. The internal wiring was bad. I thought briefly of sleeping again until daylight, but the dogs were slamming into the harness, screaming to run, so I shrugged and jumped on the rig and untied it. Certainly, I thought, running without a headlamp would not be the worst thing I had ever done. Immediately, we blew into the darkness, and the ride was madness. Without a lamp, I could not tell when the rig was going to hit a rut or a puddle. It was cloudy and fairly warm, close to 50, and had rained the night before. Without the moon or even starlight, I had no idea where the puddles were until they splashed me, largely in the face, so I was soon dripping wet. Coupled with that, tree limbs I couldn't see hit me as we passed, almost tearing me off the back of the rig. Inside an hour, I wasn't sure if I was up, down, or sideways, and the dogs stopped. They weren't tired, not even a little, judging by the way they'd been ripping through the night, but they stopped dead. I had just taken a limb in the face and was temporarily blinded. All I knew was that they had stopped suddenly and that I had to jam down the brakes to keep from running over them. It took me a couple of seconds to clear my eyes, and when I did, I saw the light. In the first seconds, I thought it was another person coming toward me. The light had an eerie green-yellow glow. It was quite bright and filled a whole part of the dark night ahead down the trail. It seemed to be moving. I was in deep woods and couldn't think what a person would be doing there. There are no other teams where I train, but I was glad to see the light at first. Then I realized the light was strange. It glowed and ebbed and seemed to fill too much space to be a regular light source. It was low to the ground and wide. I was still not frightened, and would probably not have become frightened except that the dogs suddenly started to sing. I have already talked some about their songs. There are rain songs and first snow songs and meat songs and come back and stay with us songs and even puppy training songs. But I had heard this song only once when an old dog had died in the kennel. It was a death song. And that frightened me. They all sat. I could see them quite well in the glow from the light, the soft glow, the green glow, the ghost glow. It crept into my thinking without my knowing it. The ghost glow. Against my wishes, I started thinking of all the things in my life that had scared me. Ghosts and goblins and dark nights and snakes under the bed and sounds I didn't know and bodies I had found and graveyards under covered pale moons and death and death and death. And they sang and sang. The cold song and the strange light. For a time I could do nothing but stand on the back of the wheeled rig and stare at the light with old, dusty terror. The curiosity was stronger. My legs moved without my wanting them to move, and my body followed them, alongside the team in the dark, holding to each dog like a security blanket, until I had reached the next one, moving closer to the light, until I was in front and there were no more dogs to hold. The light had gotten brighter, seemed to pulse and flood back and forth, but I still could not see the source. I took another step, then another, trying to look around the corner, deeply feeling the distance from the dogs, the aloneness. 2 more steps, then 1 more, leaning to see around the corner, and last I saw it, and when I did, it was worse. It was a form, not human, a large, standing form glowing in the dark. The light came from within it, a cold, glowing green light with yellow edges that diffused the shape, making it change and grow as I watched. I felt my heart slam up into my throat. I couldn't move. I stared at the upright form and was sure it was a ghost, a being from the dead sent for me. I could not move and might not have ever moved except that the dogs had followed me, pulling the rig quietly until they were around my legs, peering ahead, and I looked down at them and had to laugh. They were caught in the green light, curved around my legs staring at the standing form, ears cocked and heads turned sideways while they studied it. I took another short step forward and they all followed me, then another, and they stayed with me, until we were right next to the form. It was a stump. A 6-foot-tall, old rotten stump with the bark knocked off, glowing in the dark with a bright green glow. Impossible. I stood there with the dogs around my legs, smelling the stump and touching it with their noses. I found out later that it glowed because it had sucked phosphorus from the ground up into the wood and held the light from the day all night. But that was later. There in the night, I did not know this. Touching the stump, feeling the cold light, I could not quite get rid of the fear until a black and white dog named Fonzie came up, smelled the stump, snorted, and peed on it. So much for ghosts. In new snow, there can be no secrets, no mysteries. Everything leaves tracks. It is possible to see where the owl took the mouse when it tried to run across the snow in the night, the perfect pattern of the owl's wing feathers hitting the powdered snow as the bird dropped on the mouse is there. You can see the intricate necklace pattern of tracks made by hunting weasel as it looks for mice, going down into the undersnow cities the mice have in the swamp grass during the winter, then exploding out the top again with the kill and down again for another one. The tracks are always there, and they always tell the truth. But once I came on a clearing about 40 feet across, dead in the middle of the clearing, a fox had taken a grouse. On cold winter nights and days, grouse make small caves in the snow to keep from freezing, and if they are caught in the caves, they can be taken. It is easy to find the holes they make when they plummet into the snow, but very hard to catch them off guard, because when they hear the sound of someone or something coming through the snow, they explode up and out in a white cloud. But a fox had taken one in its cave and eaten it. The feathers were there, the tracks of the kill were there. But there were no tracks leading out to the center of the clearing. No fox tracks leading around the grouse cave. Nothing. No tracks leaving, no tracks coming. I tied the dogs off to a tree and took the snowshoes from the sled and spent the better part of an hour trying to work it out, moving around in the new snow. There were no fox tracks anywhere in the neighborhood. I moved out in larger and larger circles and could find no fox tracks. No sign that a fox had come from anywhere or gone anywhere. The more I looked, the less I could find. There could not have been a fox, simply could not have been one, and yet there was, somehow, one fox, one grouse, in the middle of the clearing and nowhere else on earth, a quick death, a handful of feathers, then nothing. Cedar waxwings, small cardinal-like birds that are largely gray, come in the first part of spring. You'd think that over the thousands, perhaps millions of years they have been migrating, they would have worked it out to arrive in the North Country at the right time, but they always come early, while there is still snow and no real food for them. When we see them coming in small flocks, we put out suet for them. They hit the kennels and steal meat, but they would rather have berries and seeds. Highbush cranberries taste, according to my grandmother, like somebody's old socks. Perhaps they aren't that bad, but they do smell awful when they're cooked, and it takes a lot of sugar to make highbush cranberry jelly worth eating. Maybe because of the way they taste, the berries are rarely eaten by game early in the fall when they come ripe. They freeze and hang, beautifully red and luscious-looking, for the whole winter. The color truly is wonderful against the snow. The grouse start to eat them as the winter wears on and they care less about the taste. The berries are still there in the spring, still frozen, and I happened to be sitting near a highbush cranberry stand when a flock of cedar waxwings arrived one spring afternoon, and that is where I saw another mystery that haunts me. I had always thought of birds as not terribly intelligent, although a hawk did much to change my mind. I never thought of them as counting or paying much attention to each other. But the cedar waxwings didn't just descend on the tree willy-nilly. There was great order as they settled down in rows on the limbs, 8 or 10 birds in each row. Then the bird closest to the berries in each row would take a berry carefully and hold it out to the bird next to him in his beak. That bird would take the berry and turn and pass it to the next, who would take it and turn and give it to the next, and so on until the bird at the end got the berry. Then the first bird would take another berry and pass it on, and so on until each bird in the line was holding a berry. When each bird was holding the berry, they all faced front and ate them, working the pulp off until they had the meat and spitting out the center pit. Then they would start over. My wife says it's because they hate the taste of the berries and pass them on hoping to get a sweeter one, and of course there aren't any. They're all sour. But she's just guessing, and I still do not know why they do it. The doe was something that I could not believe, even when I saw it. It happened on a night run. It had been cold, not deep cold, between 20 and 30 below at night, and very still. I was thinking of summer because my feet were cold. My toes have been frostbitten and they get cold easily. Thinking of summer or Jamaica or the inside of a red stove helps. I was thinking specifically of two summer incidents involving deer, one indescribably sweet and the other funny in a painful way. Both times, I had been fishing in a canoe. There's something about canoes. They do not cause fear. It is possible to paddle gently up to many wild animals, and they simply stand and watch. The same thing happens often with dog teams. The silence is probably the cause, but there is grace to a canoe, or a dog team, or a sailboat, which whales allow close to them. A gentle elegance that seems to fit much more into nature than the roar of an outboard or snowmobile. Perhaps for that reason, in many states, it is illegal to hunt from a canoe, deemed unfair, and the same law should apply to dog teams. One early summer, we had friends visiting us from the city. I took the man and his 4-year-old son out into the canoe to work some crappie schools. This morning, the crappies were best in close to shore, and we caught 7 or 8 good ones by hanging right on the edge of the lily pads and casting out to the deeper side. The water was very shallow where the canoe floated, not over a foot deep, and the man and I were busy fishing while the young boy, who couldn't cast yet, was having more fun hanging a lure over the shallow side and watching the dozens of small sunfish come to it and nibble. It was so still the water looked plated with the sky and absolutely quiet except for a loon that let go once in a while before diving with the high, keening wail and whoop that is so wonderfully soft and melancholy. I was just working my lure in close to the boat when I heard the boy giggle quietly, and I turned to see him reaching out to touch a fawn. She was new, maybe 2-3 weeks old, still red with the camouflage spots. She walked out in the water slowly, one careful step at a time, and stretched her nose to touch the finger the boy was holding out as if they were old friends. It was very deliberate, a youngster meeting another youngster, and I was afraid to breathe lest the moment be broken. I looked up quickly to signal the father, but he was seeing it already. His eyes were shining with it, and the moment hung in silence, a moment so incredible in all the moments there are that it seemed magic, staged. When they had touched, the fawn turned and walked slowly back up into the hazel brush, where I could see now the mother, frantic with worry, trying to get her baby to come back, and then it was gone. Silence. For a long time. Even the boy was silent. Finally I coughed. "It's all part of Disneyland of the North," I said. "The fawn comes out on a rail and you touch it and it goes back." But it was not a time for jokes, and I let it fall. We just sat for a time, watching the hazel brush where the fawn and mother disappeared, and I had one long, intense moment of gratitude that is still going on, gratitude that I have seen such a thing. The second time I was canoeing down a flat, winding river that cuts through the woods like a sluggish snake. I had gear in the canoe for a week, and I was trying to catch a muskie so I could let it go. I do not understand why I was doing this either. I have never caught a muskie so I could let it go, although I have tried for several thousand casts, and have to a large degree stopped trying to catch a muskie so I can let it go. It seemed almost a vision quest for a time, but it's fading now as I get older, and the muskie I didn't catch gets bigger, while the muskie I did catch, none, gets smaller. It was an incredibly hot day. A late August sun seemed to boil the river, and the deer flies and horse flies were not to be believed. I have never seen them worse. It must have been a peak in their cycle. They formed a thick cloud around the canoe, so that at times it was impossible to see even the bank. They all bit hard, and the blood smell from the bites brought more of them. They drank repellent like Kool-Aid, licked it off, and took more. I tried lighting a smudge in the tin can in the middle of the canoe as I paddled, which worked for mosquitoes, but it didn't bother the flies at all. They just kept eating, and soon my exposed arms and face and hands were bloody. By accident, I had discovered a partial solution. The canoe slipped into the shade under some overhanging cedars, and as if by design some of the flies moved away, back out into the sun to fly along and wait for me to come out again. In this manner I moved down the river, grabbing shade close in when I could. I was sliding under a leaning cedar when suddenly there was a tremendous crashing sound to my right. I hardly had time to turn when a doe launched herself from the thick brush on the bank in a magnificent arc that carried her up and out, higher than my head, to crash into the shallow water near the bank. Even in the split second of the event, I could see the flies. They were horrendous, a thick mass of them on her head, a swarm trailing back like a comet's tail as she flew through the air. Flies packed into her ears, into her eyes, flies to drive her mad, insane, temporarily blind. She had no idea I was there. She landed so close she drenched me with water, but in her mad run she left the bank blind, wanting only to get in the water and away from the maddening flies. She jammed her head underwater and slammed it viciously back and forth, in a swirling motion, then raised it. She snapped it out of the water and was looking straight into my eyes from a distance of 4 or 5 feet. Everything, breath, heart, everything, was absolutely still. Even the flies seemed to stop. I have never seen such anger, such defiance, compressed in a single moment. The flies had taken her beyond control, and when she saw me, her eyes opened wide in surprise, then seemed to narrow in cold rage. She didn't care that I was man, the enemy, didn't care that I was there, that she was only an arm's reach away. She didn't care about anything right then except the flies. Her eyes, her manner, all things about her for that moment seemed to say, "Mess with me and you're a dead man." Raw, irritated, frustrated, ripping anger. I didn't move, and in that very short time she realized what I was, blew out of the water in a fountain of spray and bottom mud and was gone. I thought of her now in the cold night, remembered the wonderfully hot sun cooking on my back as I paddled. Even the flies seemed to be from the warmth somehow. Musing, lost in the scene, I did not notice that the dogs were slowing and had stopped until my stomach rammed into the handlebar of the sled. "Pick it up," I said, which usually snapped them into motion, but this time they didn't move. The leader whined in unease, and the two wheel dogs turned and tried to climb back onto the sled. With their motion, several of the other dogs began to growl, and I felt the nervousness coming back from the dogs and into me. They'd acted this way before, usually when they'd run into a moose in the dark. We had been attacked by moose on a few occasions, and it was not something I wished to do again. Moose are large and essentially insane, and with an almost pathological hatred of dogs, the sled, the musher, trees, trains, cars, and everything else as near as I can figure. When they come at you, it's like getting run over by a Buick with legs. I wished I was some other place. The nervousness of the team increased, and I knew I would have to deal with it, so I set the snowhook and walked up alongside the dogs, flashing my headlamp ahead, trying to see around the slight curve to the lead dog. He was stopped in the middle of the trail with all his hair up, his lips bared, growling low in his throat. Ahead of him, slightly to the side of the trail, stood a doe. She was absolutely still, looking straight ahead over the dog. None of this made sense. Number one, a deer would not stand still that close, 4-5 feet to a dog. Number two, the dog would not normally have hesitated. He would have been on the deer or tried to get at her, and all the other dogs would join in. He never moved so fast in a run as when a deer jumped out in front of the team and bolted down the trail. They fairly flew trying to catch it. And here all of them were whimpering and cowering, spooked by one doe, who was standing absolutely still. And I was getting spooked by her. She stood staring across the dogs as if they weren't there. I pushed the dog sideways on the trail and made my way slowly to the front, closer to the deer. There weren't 3 feet between her and the lead dog, who was still whining, and still she did not move. Finally, I stood so close I could touch her. The light from my headlamp hit her eyes. They were fogged, fogged with death. I could see that she was dead, standing dead in the night wind next to the trail, guarding the winter night. She had frozen solid, on her feet, exactly as if she were alive, perfectly still and upright. It could not be, yet it was. I looked for many things in my mind to explain it. A sudden heart attack, freak paralysis. I tried to think of all the possibilities, but still it did not make sense, and we could not stay. I could not bring myself to go closer to her, and when I pulled the leader forward and lined him out on the trail and pulled the hook, the team shot past the dead doe without looking up, staring at the ground, not barking or lunging to get at her, but moving as fast as possible, moving away from that place. We have had and been owned by many dogs since we started to run them. We borrowed many initially because we did not have dogs, and they came and went, ran us for a while, then belonged to someone else. They were loved while they were with us, and missed when they left, whatever the reason. Indeed, at the time of this story, we have 41 dogs, counting the joyful madness we call a puppy pen, and each dog has taught us much. There is this dog named Fred who has lived with us for going on 9 years. When he first came to live with us, he made several sled dogs pregnant, and so we had him altered. He is loose and moves freely through the kennel, stealing food as he goes. The upshot is that between the operation and the uncontrolled eating, Fred has become enormously fat. His weight for size should be about 40 pounds, and that would be a shade heavy. Fred came to weigh over 130 pounds. He was so heavy his legs sometimes collapsed under him, so we put him on a diet, and that is when I began to see and understand temper in dogs. It was not easy to place restrictions on Fred. He was smarter than us. As soon as he started the extreme weight loss regimen, Fred began showing up with bits and pieces of food he'd buried all around the yard and kennel over the past year. We took that away and began taking the food the sled dogs had buried as well, because Fred was stealing from them. Fred still had more, food that he had hidden in the barn, and when we took even that away, he began to steal tomatoes and potatoes from the garden. Finally, when we fenced the garden and forced him to go on 2-mile walks by dragging him on a leash, Fred began to lose weight. At the same time, he lost his temper. Always a well-minded dog, he stopped coming when we called. He quit his normal watchdog duties. He'd always been a good barker if somebody drove up, and took to sitting in the yard, staring at the house. Then he bit me. Fred had never been one to bite, although he could be very single-minded in his thinking. One unforgettable incident with the electric fence illustrates his persistence. When we first put the wire in, it was just high enough to catch his tail, which he carried curled up. In due course, he clipped the wire, and the jolt put him down. In a flash of rage, and with a mighty bellowing growl, Fred turned on the wire and bit it, and was promptly knocked off his feet. Again, before I could stop him, he bit the wire, and again he was knocked down. On the third try, he backed off and thought about it. I figured he was done until he sat up and hit the wire running. Once more it hammered him, but his momentum carried the day and he broke the wire, whereupon he stood, wet on it, and walked away growling. Indeed, he still growls at the wire when he walks by. He sticks to a thing, but he isn't vicious. Yet he bit me. He studied the house, figured I was the reason for his discomfort, waited till I was walking across the yard and lifted my kneecap as deftly as a surgeon. It put me on my hands and knees, and he moved off a few feet and sat, watching me, panting quietly. I got the message, and we fed him. Small amounts, still almost starvation, but something, and Fred returned to his former cheerful self. Although I limped past him cautiously for several months, he has never popped me again, but I learned to watch the dogs for signs of irritability and temper. Different dogs, of course, have different tempers. Some are more short-tempered than others, but on one occasion I had a whole team mad at me. It made for a wild ride. The thing is, it started gently enough. My leader was a sweet dog named Cookie, and I had six dogs, all cheerful. It was on the trap line. I had checked several sets, and the weather had turned sour. By late afternoon there was a full storm blowing snow so hard it was impossible to see where we were going. The dogs always know direction, but this was before I learned to trust them, learned to understand that lead dogs know more than the person on the sled. Afraid I would get lost in the storm, I challenged every decision. If Cookie wanted to go left, I wanted to go right. If she wanted to go right, I wanted to go left or straight ahead. Each time she persisted, overriding my commands. I scolded her for fighting me, and each time I would find later that she was right. Still, I did not learn, and I continued to challenge them, often causing the team to get tangled. In time, they grew sick of my idiocy. When I went up to pull them over, floundering in the deep snow, they ignored me, tried to shrug away my hand. Still trying to be partially polite, they let me know I was being a putz, and still I persisted. Finally, I went too far. We were running along the top edge of a long ridge, higher and higher. The wind was tearing at us. I had my head buried in my parka hood and couldn't even see the front end of the team. But I was sure I knew the ridge, knew where we were, felt that I had been there before. I was absolutely dead wrong. The team went slower and slower until they were walking, lugging up the middle of the ridge, and perhaps after a quarter of a mile they stopped. I yelled at them to turn right. G is the command for right, ha for left. I knew where we were now, was sure of it, but Cookie tried to turn them left, down a long, shallow incline. I became furious at their mutiny, swore, yelled at the team, then stomped forward, grabbed Cookie by the back of her harness, and half-pulled, half-threw her off to the right. She vanished in the driving snow and wind, moving angrily in the direction I had thrown her. The team followed her, and I jumped on the sled as it went by. For 1 or 2 seconds it was all right. I stood on the brake and held the sled back, and we slithered down the hill. Then it all blew apart. With a great lurch, I felt the sled fly out into empty space and drop beneath me. I barely had time to fall backward and go into a tuck before I hit the side of a nearly vertical incline and began to tumble. I flapped and rolled for what seemed like hours, end over end. I heard the dogs falling beneath me, the sled rolling over and over, and all the gear and food being tossed out, crashing around me. With a resounding thump, the whole pile, sled, dogs, gear, and me, upside down, plummeted into a heap in the bottom of what seemed to be a deep gully. It was impossible for a moment to understand what had happened. There was not a place where I ended and the dogs and junk began. One dog, named Lad, had his nose jammed squarely in my mouth, another was in my armpit. The sled was on top of me, and if you'd asked me my name, I couldn't have told you. Cookie had knowingly taken the team over the edge of a sharp drop. It was something she never would have done on her own, but I had pushed and griped and hollered too much, and she thought it was time to give me a lesson. If I wanted to be stupid, if I persisted on being stupid, if I just couldn't resist being stupid, then she figured I had it coming and she wouldn't hold me back. It was a good lesson. But it wasn't over yet. I stood and shook the snow out of my clothes, it was actually packed into my ears, and tipped the sled upright. It took me 15 minutes to find all the gear and repack the sled, and the dogs watched me quietly the whole time. When the sled was loaded, I set to work on the dogs. They were an unholy mess, tangled so badly the gangline was in knots. The dogs were strange. While I worked to untangle them, it was almost as if I weren't there, as if a robot were working on them. They were pleasant enough, but they did not make eye contact with me. They looked straight ahead while I untangled them. They almost, but not quite, ignored me. Even the dogs that normally be jumping all over me held back. It was eerie, quiet even, with the wind blowing over the top of the gully. But after a moment I dismissed it as all in my head and went back to the sled. I pulled the snow hook and stood on the runners, and the whole team lay down. They did not drop instantly, but each and every dog, as if by silent command from Cookie, dug a bit and made a bed and lay down in the snow and went to sleep. I tried every way I knew to get them to run. Fed them, begged them, bit their ears, but they completely ignored me. I wasn't even there. They didn't get up for 18 hours. I had gone over the line. In the storm, in the pushing and yelling and driving, I had passed the point where they would accept me, run for me, pull for me, and they told me there in that gully. In that wild place, they told me, so that I would understand that they were the team, they were all of it, and if I ignored them or treated them wrong, I would know it. Finally, I pulled out my sleeping bag and made a camp of sorts and heated some tea and dozed and drank tea and thought how it was to be stupid. And later, when they felt I'd had enough, late the next day while I was still in the sleeping bag, Cookie stood and shook the snow off. The rest of the dogs did the same, shook and marked the snow. I got out of the bag and fed them and packed and stood on the sled, and they pulled up and out of the gully like a runaway train. They pulled up into the sun and loped all the way home in great joy and glee, joy they were happy to share with me. Unless I grew stupid again. It is always possible to learn from dogs, and in fact, the longer I'm with them, the more I understand how little I know. But there was one dog who taught me the most. Just one dog. Storm. First dog. He's already been spoken of once here when he taught me about heart and the will to pull, but there was much more to him. Joy, loyalty, toughness, peacefulness, all of these were part of Storm. Lessons about life and finally lessons about death came from him. He had a bear's ears. He was brindle-colored and built like a truck, and his ears were rounded when he got them so that they looked like bear cub ears. They gave him a comical look when he was young that somehow hung on to him even when he grew old. He had a sense of humor to match his ears, and when he grew truly old, he somehow resembled George Burns. At peak, he was a mighty dog. He pulled like a machine. Until we retired him and used him only for training puppies, until we let him loose to enjoy his age, he pulled his back over in the power curves so that nothing could stop a sled. In his fourth or fifth year as a puller, he started doing tricks. First, he would play jokes on the dogs pulling next to him. On long runs, he would become bored, and when we least expected it, he would reach across the gangline and snort wind into the ear of the dog next to him. I ran him with many different dogs, and he did it to all of them, chuckling when the dog jumped and shook his or her head, but I never saw a single dog get mad at him for it. Or there was once a dog named Fonzie who nearly took his head off, but Fonzie wasn't really mad at him so much as surprised. Fonzie once nailed me through the wrist for waking him up too suddenly when he was sleeping. I had reached down and touched him before whispering his name. Small jokes, gentle jokes, Storm played. He took to hiding things from me. At first I couldn't understand where things were going. I would put a booty down while working on a dog and it would disappear. I lost a small ladle I used for watering each dog, a cloth glove liner I took off while working on dog's feet, a roll of tape, and finally a hat. He was so clever. When I lost the hat, it was a hot day and I had taken the hat off while I worked on a dog's harness. The dog was just ahead of Storm, and when I kneeled down to work on the harness, he'd chewed almost to the side of it while running. I put the hat down in the snow near Storm, or thought I had. When I changed the dog's harness, I turned and looked, and the hat was gone. I looked around, moved the dogs, looked under them, then shrugged. At first I was sure I'd put the hat down. Then when I couldn't find it, I became less sure, and at last I thought perhaps I had left it at home or dropped it somewhere on the run. Storm sat quietly, looking ahead down the trail, not showing anything at all. I went back to the sled, reached down to disengage the hook, and when I did, the dogs exploded forward. I was not quite on the sled when they took off, so I was knocked slightly off balance. I leaned over to the right to regain myself, and when I did, I accidentally dragged the hook through the snow and pulled up my hat. It had been buried off to the side of the trail in the snow, buried neatly with the snow smooth over the top, so that it was completely hidden. Had the snow hook not scraped down 4 or 5 inches, I never would have found it. I stopped the sled and set the hook once more. While knocking the snow out of the hat and putting it back on my head, I studied where it had happened. Right next to Storm. He had taken the hat, quickly dug a hole, buried the hat, and smoothed the snow over it, then got back to sitting, staring ahead, looking completely innocent. When I stopped the sled and picked up the hat, he looked back, saw me put the hat on my head, and I swear smiled. Then he shook his head once and went back to work, pulling. Along with Joke, Storm had scale eyes. He watched as the sled was loaded, carefully calculated the weight of each item, and let his disapproval be known if it went too far. One winter a friend gave us a parlor stove with nickel trim. It was not an enormous stove, but it had some weight to it and some bulk. This friend lived 12 miles away, 12 miles over two fair hills, followed by about 8 miles of an old abandoned railroad grade. We needed the stove badly. Our old barrel stove had started to burn through, so I took off with the team to pick it up. I left early in the morning because I wanted to get back the same day. It had snowed 4 or 5 inches, so the dogs would have to break trail. By the time we had done the hills and the railroad grade, pushing in new snow all the time, they were ready for a rest. I ran them the last 2 miles to where the stove was and unhooked their tugs so they could rest while I had coffee. We stopped for an hour at least, the dogs sleeping quietly. When it was time to go, my friend and I carried the stove outside and put it on the sled. The dogs didn't move, except for Storm. He raised his head, opened one eye, did a perfect double take, both eyes opening wide, and sat up. He had been facing the front. Now he turned around to face the sled, so he was facing away from the direction we had to travel when we left, and watched us load. It took some time, as the stove barely fit on the sled and had to be jiggled and shuffled around to get it down between the side rails. Through it all, Storm sat and watched us, his face a study in interest. He did not get up, but sat on his back end, and when I was done and ready to go, I hooked all the dogs back into harness, which involved hooking the tugs to the rear ties on their harnesses. The dogs knew this meant we were going to head home, so they got up and started slamming against the tugs, trying to get the sled to move. All of them, that is, but Storm. Storm sat backward, the tug hooked up but hanging down. The other dogs were screaming to run, but Storm sat and stared at the stove. Not at me, not at the sled, but the stove itself. Then he raised his lips, bared his teeth, and growled at the stove. When he was finished growling, he snorted twice, stood, turned away from the stove, and started to pull. But each time we stopped, at the tops of hills, to let the dogs catch their breath after pulling the sled and stove up the steep incline, Storm turned and growled at the stove. The enemy. The weight on the sled. I do not know how many miles Storm and I ran together. 8, 10, perhaps 12 or 14,000 miles. He's one of the first dogs and taught me the most, and as we worked together, he came to know me better than perhaps even my own family. He could look once at my shoulders and tell how I was feeling, tell how far we were to run, how fast we had to run, knew it all. When I started to run along, moved from running a work team, a trapline team, to training for the Iditarod, Storm took it in stride, changed the pace down to a long trot, matched what was needed, and settled in for the long haul. He did get bored, however, and one day while we were running a long run, he started doing a thing that would stay with him, with us, until the end. We had gone 40 or 50 miles on a calm, even day with no bad wind. The temperature was a perfect 10 below zero. The sun was bright, everything was moving well, and the dogs had settled into the rhythm that could take them 100 or 1,000 miles. Then Storm got bored. At a curve in the trail, a small branch came out over the path we were running, and as Storm passed beneath the limb, he jumped up and grabbed it, broke a short piece off, about a foot long, and kept it in his mouth. All day. And into the night. He ran, carrying the stick like a toy, and when we stopped to feed or rest, he would put the stick down, eat, then pick it up again. He would put the stick down carefully in front of him or across his paws and sleep, and when he awakened, he would pick up the stick, and it would soon become a thing between us, the stick. He would show it to me, making a contact, a connection between us each time we stopped. I would pet him on top of the head and take the stick from him. He would emit a low, gentle growl when I took the stick. I'd examine it closely, nod, and seem to approve of it and hand it back to him. Each day we ran, he would pick a different stick. And each time I would have to approve of it, and after a time, after weeks and months, I realized that he was using the sticks as a way to communicate with me, to tell me that everything was all right, that I was doing the right thing. Once when I pushed them too hard during a pre-Iditarod race, when I thought it was important to compete and win, a feeling that didn't last long, I walked up to Storm, and as I came close to him, he pointedly dropped the stick. I picked it up and held it out, but he wouldn't take it. He turned his face away. I put the stick against his lips and tried to make him take it, but he let it fall to the ground. When I realized what he was doing, I stopped and fed and rested the team, sat on the sled, and thought about what I was doing wrong. After 4 hours or so of sitting, watching other teams pass me, I fed them another snack, got ready to go, and was gratified to see Storm pick up the stick. From that time forward, I looked for the stick always, knew when I saw it out the sides of his head that I was doing the right thing, and it was always there. Through storms and cold weather, on the long runs, the long, long runs where there isn't any end to it, where only the sled and the winter around the sled and the wind are there, Storm had the stick to tell me it was right. All things were right. And it came to Storm to grow old. 8, 9, then 10 years, and he slowed. He trained many pups, and finally he retired and stopped pulling. We tried to make him a pet and move him into the house, as we often do when the dogs retire, but he didn't want that, didn't want to leave the kennel. He rattled around in the house and kept trying to walk out through the windows and glass doors, so we let him outside and kept his food dish full and left him untied. For a year, Storm was the old man in the kennel. He sat in the sun and played with the pups and watched the team leave and come back, and always he had a stick. He would hold the stick when I came out to the kennels to harness and when I returned from a run. And another year passed, and he grew blind, and his thinking changed, so that he was not always aware, but still he was happy. He sat by his house, and when he heard my steps coming, he would hold a stick out for me. Sometimes I would go to his house and sit next to it in the sun, and he would lay his head in my lap with a stick in his mouth, and I would think of things I had forgotten about. Young things and old things, long runs and short runs, puppies and cold and wind, northern lights and firelight against the snow, the creaking sound of an old-fashioned lash sled moving beneath me, and the joy, the raw, cold joy of going again and again inside the diamond that is northern winter, and all was Storm. And there came a time when it was supposed to end. Storm failed and began to wander aimlessly through the kennel, bouncing off other dogs' houses, and I knew it would not be long until he faced east, as so many of them did when they died. I wanted to leave him loose for that, so he could find the right place. But we had some new dogs, and some of them were aggressive and insecure and wanted to fight all the time. They would even almost fight old Storm when he came too close to their circles, though it was very rare for young dogs to attack older, more respected ones. I did not want Storm to end that way in violence, so when I went on a trip one fall day, I left Storm tied to his chain. It was a temporary thing, just until I got back. But while I was gone, it came on Storm to end, and in the final time of his life, he somehow got the chain wrapped around his doghouse so he could not face east, could not do it properly. I saw where he had struggled and torn at the ground with his old claws to get around, to face east as so many animals do if there is time in the end, but he could not. He could not tear the chain out of the ground, could not wear it around, could not move the house, could not face east and end it right. And it was my fault. I should have known that this was the day he would end, should have felt that he was going to die. I should have known to let him loose, even if there was a risk of a fight. After all, it would be natural for him to fight. They love to fight. But I did not. It was my fault, and when death came and Storm could not face east, he knew I would be upset. Storm knew I would feel bad, and he did the only thing he could do. When I came back the next day, I went to the kennel, and there was silence until it came close, and then the dogs went into the death song, which sounds much like the rain song, and I knew then Storm was gone, knew before I saw him, knew before I even arrived at the kennel. It was a low song. It stays low and does not go into the keening whine that means excitement, and I felt all the sadness that comes with the end of a life, and went to take his body from the kennel and bury him. I found him next to his house. He had jammed into the side trying to get around to the east. The earth was torn beneath him and the chain held his head north. But he didn't blame me. I will always blame myself, but Storm did not blame me. His last act, his last thought was for me. Storm lay dead and in his mouth was a stick. The stick. Our stick. The wind seemed to scream as we cut through the night. It had been a cold week, 53 below one night, 45 below the next two, and never rising about 20 below, with wild wind out of the northwest the whole time. Somehow we had gotten caught out in the worst part of the weather. The true cold had found us 80 miles out. I was not dressed for deep cold, and I worried about the dogs. Two of them had frostbitten ears. As I treated them with ointment, I decided to hole up until the weather eased a bit, I thought overnight. I rigged a snow shelter and made a lean-to with a tarp, and dug snow caves for the dogs, and we holed up to wait until the worst of the cold had passed. We had some dog food and about 20 pounds of fat for the dogs, and I had one lovely, lovely can of Chef Boyardee ravioli. We hunkered in for the duration. I lasted a day looking at the ravioli, drinking hot tea. I had one tea bag which I used over and over. Hunger set in, and I used two small pieces of the dog's fat and mixed it with half the ravioli for a stew. It tasted wonderful, and I ate it, waited another half a day and ate the rest, and it wasn't so bad. The wind roared, but the dogs recovered. I fed them twice and recovered them, and it could have gone on. I had plenty of wood for fire, and the wind was away from me. But on the morning of the third day, I became violently ill. I thought it might be flu, when I could still think, or food poisoning from the pieces of fat. Then it didn't matter. I went into a high fever and delirium. I began to hallucinate, and while hallucinating, somebody arrived, a man I did not know, and he helped me harness my team. The wind was still bad, and the dogs did not want to leave their warm snow caves, but my helper gave me a hand. He was a short man, thick through the middle with curved, sloping, strong shoulders and great confidence and a knowledge of dogs. He shook the dogs out of the snow and made them stand in the wind and twice looked at me and smiled. His face was flat and oval, and his eyes were gentle. He signaled me to go, motioning with his hands to move the team, to get the dogs to run. I caught the sled as it went by, and I think I tried to wave at him as we left in the dark. I know, looking back on it, that it was a hallucination. I can sit and think of it and know that, but it was still real. I don't remember that whole run. It was a series of nightmares, of dreams mixed with reality, of scenes and movements and pictures. I tried to ride in the back of the sled, but I was too sick and kept falling. Fumbling in the dark and cold and wind, I used some rope to tie myself to the sled and still fell many, many times. Each time the dogs would stop and let me get back on the sled. When it was finally too much and I couldn't stand, I crawled back into the sled and wrapped myself in my sleeping bag, which the man had helped me pack, and let the dogs have me. I could not sleep, but kept going in and out of consciousness. Once, when I felt that we were stopped, I looked up out of the bag, and the man, the same man who had helped me leave the clearing, the Eskimo man, was pulling my lead dog out of a drift that had blown in over the trail. Again, when the dogs were straightened out and moving, he waved to me as the sled passed close to him. I waved back and reached for him, but could not touch him as the sled moved rapidly away. Through that long night we ran. It was very hard going for the dogs, fighting the wind and the snow, and I couldn't help them, lying half dead on the sled. Many times they were stopped, hung up in deep snow or trying to fight their way through large drifts, and each time I raised in the sled and saw the man in the parka with the wolf fur trim around the hood grab the leader by the back of the harness and help him through the hard part. Once I became sick and leaned over the side of the sled and was violently ill, and the dogs turned and came back to eat it, which made me even sicker. They were an awful mess, tangled and piled on each other and fighting over the vomit. I was so weak that I could not stand. One of them was a large dog named, of all things, Clarence, and he loved to fight. Of course, many of them do, but Clarence was so large and strong that when he fought, he could do serious damage, and he jumped on another dog named Yogi and started to kill him. He had Yogi by the throat, and I could do nothing. And the man was there again. The man with no name was there, and he smiled peacefully and quietly and untangled the dogs with his gentle competence and pulled them out straight and got them going again, then stood back as we went by, and I tried once more to touch him but could not. And again, we came to a place in the dark wind where the trail was gone. There had been a trail there when we went out, but a logging crew had gone through with a skidder and the blade had taken the trail down to bare ice. It was a steep, downhill grade, and I was not on the back of the sled where I could use the brakes. The sled began to creep up on the dogs, and as it did, it lost steering and turned sideways and rolled over. I was dumped into the side of a pine tree with gear and dog food, and the dogs balled up again in a horrible pile at the bottom of the hill. I couldn't see them well in the dark and tried to crawl to them, but everything was blurred and the man came again, the friend. He lined the dogs out and put the gear back in the sled and set the snow hook so they couldn't run until he helped me back in the sled. Then he pulled the hook and put it into the sled, and I waved once more and thanked him. He ignored me and called the dogs with a short sound, a word that sounded like an explosion in his mouth. Acha! And the dogs took off again, running for him, and I went into the sleep unconsciousness once more. Somewhere there was a lake with bad ice, and the front end of the team picked their way across it, and somewhere we ran down a creek bed on the ice, and there was open water, and the dogs worked around it. I saw these things as if in a dream. We bounced off many trees, and I hit my head several times and was sick again, though the dogs kept going this time. And finally I remembered and saw nothing until I felt the sled was stopped dead. I opened my eyes and saw that we were in the kennel and the dogs were rolling and scratching at their harnesses, waiting to be let out so that they could shake their legs and sleep in their houses. My wife came out and helped me. I was staggering and not being effective at putting them away, and I tried to tell her about the man, my new friend, but it came out all confused. So I stopped and thought I would tell her later, but I didn't, somehow, and did not speak of him or see the man, my new friend, again for a long time. Until I had trained in Minnesota and gone north into Alaska to run in the Iditarod and hit a place called the Burn. It is, of course, madness, a kind of channeled, focused madness, the Iditarod. The idea is that the musher will take a team and go from downtown Anchorage to downtown Nome, some 1,100-plus miles across Alaskan wilderness, over mountain ranges, up the Yukon River, out to the coast of the Bering Sea, and up along the coast and across parts of the sea ice to Nome. That is the idea. And on the face of it, with the world the way it is now, with planes and computers and cars with brains and comfort-controlled environments and every single whim catered to by technology, with all of that, all that we have become, it doesn't somehow seem possible to do something so basic and elemental. It is such a massive undertaking, such a logistical complication to train a team and take them up to Alaska and run the race. The only way to do it is to break it down into simple, small units of time. The first one took 17 days and 14 hours, and it can be remembered best in days. The race. Day 1. Out of Anchorage. Just madness. There's no sleep the night before, 2 nights before, trying to get everything ready, no sleep, no rest. The food is all shipped to 20 checkpoints across the state. The dogs are trucked into downtown Anchorage to the staging area on 4th Street, where there is, ridiculously, no snow, and they must bring it in trucks. Because the snow is shallow, the sleds cut through to the bare asphalt, so there's no steering, no real control. The dogs are insane to run. We pull number 32, about the middle of a 70-team race, and the dogs get to stand and watch 31 teams go out ahead of them, out and down 4 blocks to turn sharp right and head out of the downtown section. 31 teams to watch, and then they take us into the chutes, and the dogs know it is our time. They lunge and tear and pull and scream until they count us down and we are released. Some new dogs, some old. Cookie is there, and Storm and Fonzie and Columbia and Yogi from the work team, and new dogs that I almost don't know yet. Forward. They blow out of the chutes, so hard that my arms are jerked nearly out of the sockets, and I cannot believe they are the same 15 dogs I have trained, have run so many times before. I'm as nothing in the rear of the sled, nothing. We pound the 4 blocks in a heartbeat. I know we cannot make the turn, and we don't. The dogs sweep around. There is a moment when there seems to be control, and then I roll over and over, but hang onto the sled somehow and slide out of downtown Anchorage on my face, dragging on the back of the sled like garbage. Only the sled and the dogs and the team matter. So little is known of other teams until much later, after the first 3 days. Some do not make it out of Anchorage. One musher breaks an arm, another a shoulder. 3, 5 blocks out and they must scratch. And that is the worst. To scratch. Before the race it is spoken of as a disease. I am a leper, I will scratch. It is the same. Many will, but nobody wants to. Everyone wants to finish. I regain control of the team, get back upright on the runners, and somehow get out of Anchorage. It is still not real, a dream. Finally out of the chutes, really, really starting to run the Iditarod, the dream, the run. And it's all phony. The show start in Anchorage is done for television, to give Anchorage publicity. Teams can't truly go from Anchorage to Nome because the freeway system coming into Anchorage blocks the trail. The whole first start, the madness of it, the chutes, all of it has to be done over. 30 miles out of town is a suburb of Eagle River, where the dogs are put in trucks and taken 11 miles to Settlers Bay, where the race truly starts. More chutes. More slamming and screaming and waiting for the front teams to leave, and again, madness. The dogs blow out of the starting chutes and scramble for speed, and this time it is into the bush, directly into the wilderness, but this sham start and restart is taken all day, and so the race truly starts at the end of day, close to dark. With the darkness comes chaos. The teams will not rest this first night. They are too excited and must be allowed to run until they settle in, so the darkness brings a particular insanity of passing teams and tangles and moose. Moose. My team stops dead in the dark, and I go up to investigate the reason and find my leader. Some run 2 leaders, but I favor one, a sweet but simple dog named Wilson. I am trying to get him to lead so I can save Cookie for later, and I find him with his head between the back legs of a moose, frozen with terror. The moose, a large cow, turns to look at me when my headlight comes across her, then turns away. I do not have a gun. I do not know what to do. "What the hell are you waiting for?" a voice demands suddenly from the rear as another team runs up on mine in the dark. "Why are we stopped?" "There's a moose," I yell back lamely. "Well, kick it in the butt and get it moving or get out of the way." I try, kicking the moose in the left flank, and to my amazement she jumps and moves slowly off the trail so we can pass. Later in the race I will try this again, and the second moose will jump on me instead of off the trail, making my life very interesting for about 5 seconds. Anon. In the confusion, my leader gets lost and takes a wrong turn while I'm looking down at the sled bag, and we go 40, 50 miles in the wrong direction, up into some canyons where the trail gets narrower and narrower, and finally it stops. I go up to the front of the team in the darkness and drag them around, realizing we are lost. My clothes have been ripped on tree limbs, my face is bleeding from cuts, and when I look back down the side of the mountain we have just climbed, I see 27 headlamps bobbing up the trail. 27 teams have taken our smell as a valid trail and are following us. 27 teams must be met head-on in the narrow brush and passed and told to turn around. It is a nightmare. The whole crazy night, turning teams, stopping fights, yelling at dogs, and waiting in armpit-deep snow until finally we are back on the right trail, and just before dawn, I can stand it no longer, 3 nights now without sleep, and I pull the team off on a narrow turnoff and sit on the sled to rest, to doze. I was not there 10 minutes, lying back with my eyes closed when I heard footsteps on the snow. An older man who was famous stood next to me in the darkness and smiled down and said, "Would you like a chocolate chip cookie?" Wonderfully, incredibly, miraculously, he has somehow gotten 2 chocolate chip cookies through that mad night without breaking them. He handed me one, and I sat up and poured tea from my thermos into my cup and his, and we drank the tea and dunked the cookies and did not talk but just sat. I looked at my watch and found it was exactly 24 hours since we were in the staging area in downtown Anchorage waiting to get in the starting chute. It is the end of the first day. Day 2. At dawn, we break into the open from thick, dark forest and are treated to a spectacular sight. The sun coming over our rear lights up the entire Alaska range across our front. There are no clouds, and the mountains, McKinley on the right, tower over us in dazzling white enormity, filling the sky while the sun warms our backs and the dogs finally settle into running. The madness of the night is gone. The front-end teams, the faster runners, have moved on, and we, the dogs and I, are left to get down to the business of running better than 1,000 miles. It is a strange thing to do. The dogs are magnificent. They are the true athletes of the Iditarod. The dogs continually cause wonder with their endurance, joy, and intelligence, but they have tremendous needs. They must be fed a snack every hour or so, and 3 or more hot meals a day. Their shoulders must be rubbed every hour, and they must be allowed to shake the lactic acid buildup out of their joints each hour. And their feet. God, their feet. I am being pulled by 15 dogs, and that makes 60 feet to be taken care of, to be watched, and rubbed with ointment and covered with booties if need be. So much time will be spent on my hands and knees that I have sewn half-inch foam pads into my pants at the knees to keep my legs from freezing when I kneel in the snow. And in this business of running, this whole business of getting started and settling down to taking care of the dogs, in the tension and speed of the race, I do not notice when we start climbing, beginning the long run up into the mountains. We move through the day up in some frozen rivers and across some frozen lakes, and when it gets dark again, we come into the first of 20 checkpoints. Noise and pandemonium. Dog teams coming and going, judges and spectators all around, small planes landing on the ice and taking off. The dogs cannot rest because of the noise. I get my sacks of food and we head up the river a bit to be alone, but still they do not rest. They sit and watch other teams coming and going, watch the planes taking off over us. Even in the dark, in the willows at the side of the river, it is crowded. A man with a team wanders in circles out in front of me, the dogs running around and around on the ice, jumping from one snowmobile trail to the next, and circling back, confused by all the trails in the darkness. Everybody is confused. When it is clear that the dogs will not rest, I hook up their tugs and we start off again. We luckily find the right trail, and as we leave the checkpoint, the man whose team was wandering follows us out. That night passes again in confusion. Teams pass us. We pass other teams. I stop to rest the dogs again, but they still will not sleep. Won't indeed for 2 more nights. So I let them run. The snow is unbelievably deep. When I stop them and run up alongside the team at one point to work on their feet, I mistakenly step off the trail and go in up to my armpits. I have to crawl out by grabbing at the dogs and using them for an anchor. And my brain fries that second night. Sleep deprivation catches me and I start hallucinating. We've been warned about that in briefings, along with frostbite, wind, whiteouts, wind, intense cold, and finally, wind. But nothing can prepare you for your first hallucinations in the race because they're not dreams, not something from sleep or delirium. The intensity of the race, the focused drive of it, makes for a kind of exhaustion in the musher not found in training. The hallucinations seem to roar at you. They come while you are awake, come with your eyes open, and are completely real. There is a small bit of snow that spurts up from each dog's foot as they run, a little white jet, and that turns in my mind into flame. I see my dogs all running in flame, their feet and lower legs on fire. Terrified, I set the snow hook and run up to put the fire out, lean down to pat the flames out, and of course they disappear, are not there. But the vision comes again and again until at last I somehow reconcile myself by thinking it is all right because the flames do not hurt the dogs. I'm amazed that they can run in liquid fire and not feel pain or get injured. The hallucinations do not go away. Indeed, they get more complicated. Often I nearly get lost by going up rivers that aren't there, following lights that do not exist. At one point, I have a man sitting on my sled. He's wearing a trench coat and a pair of horn-rimmed glasses and is holding a manila folder full of official-looking papers. As I watch, he turns to look up at me. He is very distinct, and I can see the wrinkles in the fabric of his coat, my own reflection in his glasses. He turns to look at me and begins to speak in a low voice, about federal educational grants. He is the most boring human being I've ever met, as dull as thick mud, and he goes on and on until at last I yell at him to shut up. The dogs stop and look back at me, and of course I'm alone. It is only in the night when the hallucinations are bad, between about 11 and 4 in the morning, and I will not learn how to truly control them for another day and a half. The night drags on forever as the dogs keep trotting, and I reel in and out of half-sleep on the back of the sled, but at long last it is dawn. There is cold now at dawn, deep cold. It is perhaps 50 below. And I come alongside a musher whose teeth are chattering, a bad sign, while he tries to get a fire going. Cold, he says. The word is a benediction. I nod from the closed tunnel of my parka hood and pull my team over to rest. They are at last ready to stop. It is the end of day 2. Day 3. We must cross the Alaska Range. Somebody before the race kept saying it was the highest mountain range in North America, which is true, and it takes all of this day climbing and another one climbing still more to get up into the peaks. We pass through 3 more checkpoints, 2 of them villages with children running out to watch the teams come through. They are intensely curious and study each thing I do as I feed and take care of the dogs. 1 checkpoint is a trapper's cabin where we may stop but are not allowed inside the cabin. My team is very slow, much slower than most other teams, and I realize on this day that I will be very lucky to finish the race, let alone do well. Finishing is all I originally wanted, but the hot worm is always there, the thought that maybe your dogs are special and will prove themselves better than Rick's or Susan's or any of the other front-end runners. It is a futile dream, a strange thought to have, but it is there nonetheless, until this third day. The mountains, the climbing and climbing, have a way of establishing reality. As the team climbs into the peaks above Timberline and comes out of the Rainy Pass checkpoint, where there are 30 or so other teams stopping to feed and rest, I have entered into a state of almost idiotic bliss. I am tired beyond belief. Beyond how it was in the Army, beyond anything I have known, I am tired. But the team is moving and seems healthy and everybody is eating and drinking, and the scenery is so beautiful that it doesn't matter how far we're behind. I am steeped in beauty. It is like going back 10,000, 12,000 years. Running over these mountains with a dog team, like becoming a true human, a human before we became cluttered by civilization, like going inside and becoming a cave painting. We end the third day in the Rainy Pass checkpoint, resting. I sit on the sled and stare at the dogs while they sleep. My eyes close, and when they open again, it seems a moment, 4 hours have passed. Yogi is up, jerking around, wanting to fight, and I realize it is time to go. Day 4. Over Rainy Pass and down through Dalzell Gorge. Everybody warned the rookies about the gorge, also known as the Gut and the Chute. It is a 20-mile downhill run through a river gorge studded with boulders, and you run on an ice ledge steeply down, weaving in and out of the boulders for the whole distance. The other mushers tell the rookies that it is easy to get in trouble in the gorge. And it is. In a moment of sheer stupidity, worried that I will lose my team, I tie my left arm to the sled. Seconds later, I'm knocked off the sled, and as the dogs careen down through the gorge, they loop out and around a boulder, but the sled does not make it cleanly and hits the boulder, and I am knocked off the runners, and I cannot get up. I bounce, bang off the boulder, swing back and forth like a piece of meat. I seem to do most of the gorge run on my back, whamming boulders with the top of my head. Through a miracle or two, my stupidity in tying myself to the sled does not kill me. A musher stopped at the end of the gorge, fixing his broken sled, grabs my team and pulls them to a stop as they pile into a small side ravine, or I think it would have been worse. Tattered, bleeding, ragged, and stunned, I come out of the end of the gorge to crash in the next checkpoint and spend the day recovering. It is the end of day 4. Day 5. At Roan River, I take my 24-hour mandatory layover. I sleep on the ground with the dogs near a small cabin that is the checkpoint, and when I awaken, it is about mid-morning. I have about 10 hours before I am due to leave, and I find that we're on a small island in a frozen river. It is the most beautiful spot I've ever seen. The island is surrounded by mountains that shoot up to the sky. The peaks tower over the cabin, making it look like a jewel in a giant, magnificent setting. I go to the backside of the island for water for the dogs and stand level with the bottom edge of the mountain that seems to go up forever. I have to turn my head back and up to see the peak covered with snow. It is like a cathedral. My head stops aching and the sharp pain in my ribs goes down as I sit on a log and drink tea and let the beauty work into me for that whole day. Rumors tear through the checkpoint like wildfire. 1 man is missing and feared dead. 2 men are missing and feared dead. 1 woman was attacked by a moose and killed. Somebody was dragged to death coming down Rainy Pass in the gorge. None of the rumors are true, but they fly back and forth through the resting teams at the checkpoint, and I would be more worried by them except that I had been in the army and it was the same kind of rumor engine. Late afternoon comes, and the checker tells me I can go. The dogs fairly hum with energy, having slept and rested for a full 24 hours. I stand on the sled and reach to release the snowhook, but before I can, they lunge and break the rope, and I am gone out of the checkpoint, looking back at the snowhook as I leave. It is the end of day 5. Day 6. In the dark, we roar wildly through some trees that come so close to the trail the sled.